Thursday, November 7, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Did the elections this past Tuesday point to the future? Do they point to the 2014 off-year elections and then to the 2016 presidential election? Time will tell, but the debate has already started. What's not debatable is what took place on Tuesday. In one of the most significant elections, New Yorkers elected a new mayor. The headlines in the nation's national newspapers tell us pretty much what happened. For instance, the New York Times says that Bill de Blasio's election as the first Democrat to hold the position in over 20 years, quote, signals a leftward shift after the Bloomberg era. Similarly, the Wall Street Journal says that the election indicates that New York is about to take a left turn. These kinds of elections are very interesting because they point to major political shifts that also indicate moral shifts, shifts in the way people think. In New York, citizens had repeatedly elected corporate types, business types, who ran the city like a business and achieved unquestionable victories. For instance, bringing down the massive crime rate in New York to near record low levels. But what happened in terms of the election on Tuesday was a significant populist turn. As Michael Barbaro of the New York Times says, he won support, that is Bill de Blasio, from voters regardless of race, gender, age, education, religion, or income. His lopsided outcome, he says, represented the triumph of a populist message over the kind of corporate leadership New York had elected in recent years. Sophia Hollander, writing for the Wall Street Journal, says for the past 12 years, the nation's largest city has been run by one of the country's wealthiest corporate titans. That would be 30 times over billionaire Michael Bloomberg, a self-declared iconoclast untethered to either party. But on Tuesday, New York overwhelmingly elected an unabashed liberal activist and political strategist who is sympathetic to the Occupy Wall Street movement and once spent time in Nicaragua supporting the Sandinistas. Hollander went on to write, political analysts say the election of Democrat Bill de Blasio, who ran on a platform of raising taxes on the wealthy to fund education programs, cracking down on aggressive police tactics known as stop and frisk, and creating a more inclusive, collaborative government, could become the biggest test yet of a recent revival of liberalism in American political life that is occurring in urban areas, end quote. Speaking to the New York Times, John H. Mollenkopf, director of the Center for Urban Research at the City University of New York, said it's huge. Liberalism is not dead in New York City. To the Wall Street Journal, Stuart Rothenberg, editor of the nonpartisan Rothenberg Political Report, said, we're seeing more and more in the Democratic Party a sense of confidence and outspokenness among progressives, that is, an uptick and an upsurge in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, especially in urban America, and particularly in this case, in New York City. Meanwhile, Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, said that this could have its limits. Speaking of these new liberal mayors, he writes, if they show themselves to be incompetent, then they'll pay a price. And it's happened before. For instance, one of the most interesting aspects of Bill de Blasio's election is that all he has ever managed to this point is a staff of 40 people and an annual budget of $2.3 million. Let me repeat that. 40 people, $2.3 million. The city that has just elected a mayor employs around 300,000 people and has an annual operating budget of $69.9 billion. Fred Siegel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, said, quote, I have no trouble praising de Blasio's political skills. It's his governing that worries me, end quote. But intellectual brilliance does not always guarantee managerial competence, and the ability to run a brilliant campaign and to win office does not necessarily indicate the ability to perform well once in office. That brings to mind an anecdote I included in my most recent book, The Conviction to Lead. Lyndon Johnson, who became president after the death of John F. Kennedy, was very impressed by Kennedy's collection of managerial experts. When he gushed about them to former Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn, the Speaker retorted, quote, well, Lyndon, you may be right, and they may be every bit as bright and intelligent as you say, but I'd feel a whole lot better about them if just one of them had run for sheriff once, end quote. Meanwhile, the most interesting statement about Bill de Blasio's election was made by Harold Ickes, a liberal political strategist and former White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Bill Clinton. He's also a mentor to the newly elected mayor. He said of Bill de Blasio, Bill will be the most liberal big city mayor in America today, and a lot of people are going to be watching. He then asked the obvious question, can he pull it off? Not only will people in New York be watching, but the rest of the nation as well. Meanwhile, in neighboring New Jersey, the citizens of that state elected their incumbent governor, Chris Christie, to a second term. He won with 61% of the vote. As is explained by Kate Zernike and Jonathan Martin of the New York Times, in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans by over 700,000, Mr. Christie, the Republican, won decisively. making impressive inroads, exit polls found, among younger voters, blacks, Hispanics, and women, groups that Republicans nationally have struggled to attract. This is going to be a very interesting issue for the Republican Party because Chris Christie now emerges, given this overwhelming re-election victory in New Jersey, as a front runner for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. And this will be a very interesting situation because remember that what happened in 2012 was that Republicans nominated a man who would win election as the governor of a blue state, that is, a Republican who was elected in an overwhelmingly Democratic state. In that case, it was Governor Mitt Romney, who was elected years ago as governor of the state of Massachusetts. Now it's Governor Chris Christie. And the question is, does he now fit the times? It will be a very interesting setup for a fascinating debate, which will take place undeniably in the Republican Party going forward. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, another discussion is sure to be taking place. In the state of Virginia, Clinton loyalist Terry McAuliffe, a former chairman of the Democratic Party, had been expected to win overwhelmingly as he was elected as the Democratic candidate. He was elected, but not overwhelmingly. As a matter of fact, he received 47% of the vote, and Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican candidate, received 46% of the vote, an astonishingly narrow margin in an election that had been expected to have a very wide result. The impact from all of this is going to lead to an immediate debate in the Democratic Party because it became very, very clear that what dragged Terry McAuliffe down in terms of the voting was Obamacare, that is, the Affordable Care Act, and an enormous public resentment about the way that law has been implemented and the plan has been rolled out. This is leading to a great deal of consternation on the side of the Democrats, wondering what in the world the 2014, not to mention the 2016 elections will look like if the Affordable Care Act ends up being a disaster and goes on having the kind of resentment and pushback that it currently has with the American public. From a Christian worldview perspective, one of the interesting things to watch here is how political parties respond to this kind of information coming from off your elections. You should expect the political parties, in terms of the fact that they have a common mind, will try to do their very best to put themselves in a better situation for the next election. They'll try to solve or resolve problems that emerged in this election in order to capitalize on opportunities in the next. But this is going to set up some very interesting debates on issues that are very important to the Christian conscience. For instance, on the Republican side, will the winning argument be that the Republican Party needs to separate from so many of the moral issues that have driven so many of its constituents and its candidates in recent election cycles? Will issues such as homosexuality, same-sex marriage, abortion, euthanasia, and a host of other issues become just an embarrassment to the Republican Party? Is that what the re-election of Chris Christie represents, and is that the direction for the future of the party? Time will tell. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, a remarkable moral transformation has taken place, and what we're looking at there is the fact that the challenge to that party is its very restive and indeed eager left wing, with liberalism on the ascendancy. It's likely, thus, that we're looking at a political situation that is at present cloudy and may remain that way for some time. Both parties are going to be making big decisions about their future, what they actually believe, and the kind of candidates they will intend to run. Meanwhile, Tuesday's election included some other interesting features. For one thing, six different states voted on 31 different ballot initiatives. In perhaps one of the most significant of these, the voters in the state of New York decided to approve a constitutional amendment to expand casino gambling. Voters in that state approved the expansion to at least 7 Las Vegas-style casinos to open in the state. This is a very regrettable development, and it is one that was sold to the people of New York as an alternative to raising taxes. What we see here is that in almost every case, not every case, but almost every case, where the citizens of a state or of a political unit are told you can vote for either an expansion of gambling or for raising taxes, the voters will go for the gambling almost every time. It is because they deceive themselves into believing that gambling isn't a tax. It is, as some analysts have said, a tax on the stupid. And in some cases, a tax on those who are least able to pay the tax. It is an evasive political maneuver, not only by a government, but in this case, by its citizens as well. Meanwhile, in the state of Colorado, voters there decided to set a tax rate for selling what is euphemistically described as recreational marijuana. As John Ingold of the Denver Post reports, a measure to impose hefty taxes on recreational marijuana passed easily Tuesday as voters across the state overwhelmingly chose to make pot one of the most heavily taxed consumer products in Colorado. This was known as Proposition AA. It won by about 65% to 35%. Colorado's Attorney General and a number of marijuana business owners, they supported Proposition AA. Governor John Hickenlooper also supported the tax measure, despite his opposition to the marijuana legalization. Marijuana, Cheetos, and goldfish, all legal in Colorado. Nonetheless, the governor exulted on Twitter, "Now we'll have the dollars to regulate, enforce, and educate. Such a deal." According to the voter guide that was presented to the voters of Colorado, the measure was expected to bring in $67 million a year. Of that, $27.5 million is to be generated by an excise tax that would go towards school construction, all paid for by sales of marijuana. A second lesson in this. When voters are given the opportunity to vote on something they know isn't right and isn't good, but is sold for the cause of education, they'll often go for it. That's how state lotteries got into place in many of the southern states in the United States, and that's how now a legal excise tax on the sale of recreational marijuana has been voted in by the overwhelming majority of the citizens of Colorado. And the governor, who said he was against the legalization of marijuana, he's all for getting all the money he can get from the sale of marijuana. Consider a third and very dangerous point in this. The state of Colorado is now in the position where the only way it can increase the amount of revenue upon which it will become very dependent from the sale of marijuana is to get its own citizens to buy more marijuana, to smoke more marijuana, to use more marijuana. In other words, it's just like the lottery, it's just like gambling. The only way the state can increase its revenue is to get more people to gamble more money. And the only way they can get more revenue from marijuana is to get more of their citizens to buy more and smoke more. Oh, and by the way, consider the numbers again. The tax is expected to bring in $67 million a year. 27.5 is to go to education. Where is the rest of it going to go? Well, here's the Denver Post to answer that question. Quote, "The rest of the money will go toward paying for the regulation of the pot shops, as well as any associated impacts of legalization." End quote. You heard it right. More money is going to go to pay for the impact of the legalization of marijuana and the regulation of pot shops than is going to go to education. You just have to wonder how many people in Colorado had factored that in when they made their vote. Meanwhile, also on Tuesday, but not by a citizen vote, the state of Illinois moved much closer to the legalization of same-sex marriage. As Sophia Turin and Carrie Lester reported for the Associated Press, historic votes on Tuesday in the Illinois legislature positioned that state to become the largest in the American heartland to legalize gay marriage, following months of arduous lobbying efforts by both sides in President Barack Obama's home state. The House of Representatives in Illinois approved the measure by 61-54 and then sent it on to the Senate. The Senate has already approved the legalization of same-sex marriage. The issue now are some legal technicalities to be worked out between the House and the Senate. The bill heads next to Governor Pat Quinn of Illinois, who has said that he will sign it, and legal same-sex marriages are then likely to begin in the state of Illinois on June the 1st of 2014. At that point, Illinois would, if no other state acts before it, become the 15th state in the Union, plus Washington, D.C., to have allowed and legalized same-sex marriage. The Associated Press, along with just about everyone else on both sides of the issue, is pointing to the fact that this is part of a massive moral shift taking place in American culture. As they write, polls show support for gay marriage has surged since 1996, when the Gallup poll found that 27% of Americans backed it. Now Gallup finds the majority support giving gay and lesbian couples the right to marry, end quote. One interesting thing about that, they did not cite the numbers of the current Gallup poll in terms of support. It is a bare majority, but to give the poll its credit, it is a majority. President Obama, who as recently as just over a year ago opposed the legalization of same-sex marriage before changing his mind and supporting it, he said this, quote, "Michelle and I are overjoyed for all the committed couples in Illinois whose love will now be as legal as ours, and for their family and friends who have long wanted nothing more than to see their loved ones treated fairly and equally under the law," end quote. Meanwhile, in the Washington Post, a very interesting article appeared by Juliet Elperin. It's entitled, "Why Legalizing Gay Marriage is Going to Get Harder." It's an insightful article with very good political analysis. The bottom line in all of this is that the states most likely to legalize same-sex marriage, well, once Illinois acts, most of those states have already acted. The remainder of the states are going to be much more difficult. After all, if Illinois goes forward, as expected, it will become the 15th state to legalize same-sex marriage. You do the math, that leaves 35. And those 35 states are likely to present very difficult, if not insurmountable, barriers to any fast movement toward the legalization of same-sex marriage. For instance, 29 of those 35 states have constitutional amendments prohibiting same-sex marriage. In other words, in those 29 states, the state's constitutions have been amended such that same-sex marriage is impossible and illegal. The state's legislatures thus cannot adopt same-sex marriage without first going to the voters and asking them to change their mind and to amend the Constitution again, this time either to remove the prohibition to same-sex marriage or to officially legalize same-sex marriage. As this Washington Post article indicates, that's going to be a much more difficult task. Mark Solomon, national director of the group Freedom to Marry, said, quote, "We're going to be entering an era where most of the legislative fights are over, and we're going to have to undo constitutional amendments and do that at the ballot box," end quote. Then the Washington Post explains that terrain has traditionally favored defenders of traditional marriage. 29 states now have voter-approved constitutional bans on gay marriage. One state, Minnesota, defeated a proposed ban, and three states, Maine, Maryland, and Washington, legalized same-sex marriage through a statewide vote, end quote. Making the point emphatically was Fred Sains, Vice President for Communications and Marketing at the Human Rights Campaign. He said, quote, "We are quickly running out of the states where this is an easy lift," end quote. The next two battleground states for citizen involvement are likely to be Arizona and Oregon. Meanwhile, this means that the massive shift is going to be into the courts and away from the legislatures, and court challenges are going to be erupting in virtually every state which does not at present have legalized same-sex marriage. But this very long battle in the courts is not where the advocates of same-sex marriage are headed. They see their rescue in only one place, and that is the United States Supreme Court. Sayings of the Human Rights Campaign put it bluntly, quote, "No one is under any illusions that marriage is going to come to all 50 states through any other venue than the United States Supreme Court," end quote. If honest, that's where the opponents and the defenders of same-sex marriage are on common ground. Everyone knows that eventually, inescapably, this issue will be decided by the United States Supreme Court. Finally, in what may be the most interesting if bizarre developments from the election on Tuesday, in Colorado, 11 counties in the eastern portion of the state, far more conservative than the liberal enclaves of Denver and Boulder and Aspen, they were calling for the right to secede from the state of Colorado and establish a 51st state. But only in six of those counties did a sufficient number of citizens vote for secession, and now it looks like the whole thing may be doomed because those six counties will not be large enough to constitute a workable state. But what this indicates, if nothing else, is that the cultural conflict in America is even demonstrated in one state, in this case the state of Colorado, where voters in six counties voted to leave the state entirely, while the rest of the state's deciding on what the tax rate will be for legalized marijuana. The left and the right are often living in proximity to one another, but in Colorado it is a very volatile political situation. And, as bizarre as it may appear to those outside the state, something very similar exists in almost every state in the Union. Meanwhile, in what may be the most bizarre development of all on Tuesday, in what USA Today calls the ultra-liberal city of Tacoma Park, Maryland, 16- and 17-year-olds were invited to vote. As reporter Natalie DeBlasio writes, in Tacoma Park, 16- and 17-year-olds hopped in line to vote. In May, the Washington Suburb City Council voted to become the first U.S. city to lower its voting age from 18 to 16. What's not reported is how many 16-year-olds were actually interested enough to vote. Political analysts and political scientists will be looking at all the data from Tuesday's election, trying to figure out what it means politically. Christians will be interested in those issues, but will look much deeper at what an election that took place on a day like Tuesday means for the direction of the country, morally as well as economically, culturally as well as politically. And it will take some time to take the measure of these questions. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.